Good morning. So today we're starting lesson three, the Christian period. It's always our goal to finish one lesson per class. Still working on that. So the first two lessons were about the Bible, its inspiration, and Genesis. The second lesson was about the Mosaic dispensation, the Old Testament, what it's comprised of, what it meant, what it means for us. And today we're hitting the Christian period. How long did the Christian period last for?
Oh, yeah.
Well done. So in the lesson book, Brother Harkrider's created a lot of helpful graphics, particularly for this lesson. I know not everyone has the book, so I made sure to scan the graphics and put them up on the screen for us. Is that coming across? Oh, that's super clear. Oh, awesome. Well done. Okay, so this practically is a timeline of the church. It's a little confusing because the timeline seems to end in 97 AD, but really it ends at the second coming of Christ, which, as far as I'm aware, hasn't happened yet, much less in 97 AD. The establishment of the church on Pentecost occurs in the book of Acts, chapters 1 through 6. The church is scattered through persecution over the next two chapters. Saul is converted in Acts 9. There's the conversion of Cornelius in Acts 10. What's important about the conversion of Cornelius? Why was that one? Oh, he's the first Gentile Christian. Everyone up until this point, Jewish Christians. Paul goes on a series of trips over the next several chapters. He's thrown in prison. And so the book of Acts really covers the entire written history of the church in terms of a description of what had happened in the first century. That's the most complete record we have. We know that at some point after the last chapters of Acts that the city of Jerusalem was destroyed. That destruction seemed to fulfill a number of prophecies that have been made over the course of the New Testament. And then after the destruction of Jerusalem, there was a couple of more inspired writings. If you look at the bottom half of the screen, and to the right, you'll see all the books of the New Testament and approximately when they were written. I will definitely work on getting a better projection of that in the future. 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, as far as we know, are probably the very first inspired writings of the Christian period. Which was the first gospel that was written? Luke probably, what I've read and studied is that Mark, because Mark seems to be the simplest and to have the least details, it's as if Mark was writing to an audience that, you know, was pretty familiar with the story, and the more detailed the accounts get, the purpose for that is people aren't as familiar, they weren't there, they didn't see it. But they're all kind of written in that same period anyway. So Matthew was written at the same time. Matthew's gospel appears to be largely based on Mark's gospel. Paul writes a few more letters. Later, Luke, James, Acts, and a bunch more letters are written. The last of the gospels that's written is the book of John. And aside from the evidences, aside from the archaeological evidences, what would lead you to believe that the book of John was the last of the four Gospels written? Oh, no, no. They're just the Gospel, the, you know, fourth book of the New Testament.
It's
Very, very different from the other three. So I think if you're a historian, you're looking at it, if you're looking at the textual evidence, the design, Matthew and Mark are fairly similar. They make a lot of Jewish references, so they seem to be either writing to a primarily Jewish audience, or they're writing to people that are unfamiliar with the customs of Jews, so they're having to go through it and, like, explain it, right? A lot of Matthew and Mark are, like, just a straight narrative, right? It's like, just like we've been studying, Jesus is, like, the protagonist of Matthew and Mark. And in Matthew and Mark, mainly what's emphasized is his supernatural powers and you know, his pronouncements, right? Luke's a different thing. Luke includes a lot more details, and it's less a narrative, like we'd studied before, and more of a history. He's trying to pin down where were people at what times and what did they do while they were there, right? So you can kind of tell that Luke probably came after the first two. Luke's heard the stories, but now he's trying to pin down the events. By the time you get to John, and John almost universally is understood to be the last of the Gospels that's been written, the language and the teaching from the book of John is very different than what had happened before. It's a much more theological gospel. He has a lot of things to say about belief and why we should believe. It's more of a sermon than the two narratives in the history, right? He's got some things about Jesus that people need to know that don't necessarily involve his miracles or the names, dates, and places of the people he associated with, right? So they're all being derived from each other. There's sort of an evolution of the process that's internally consistent. So we've previewed these New Testament books. I want to break these up. You can think of the Gospels as being history books. They are describing the events that Jesus and his initial disciples went through, and you can lump that into that the Acts of the Apostles. All of the rest of the books, we call them epistles, but epistles is really just a fancy word for letters. Even the book of Revelation is actually like a chain letter, right? It's like, here's seven things I need to say to these seven churches. Please pass this around. Also, all this apocalyptic stuff. The Gospels are written by four men. Who can name them? Ah, you see why this is the basic Bible doctrine, basic humor. Okay, so these are some very famous statues that were created during the Renaissance to describe, you know, to illustrate what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John would have looked like, right? So which one do you think is John? I'm sorry? The first one? What makes you think it's the first one? That's a thick book. Okay, so one of the things, if you're running around seeing some Christian art, you might be in Europe. Sometimes we go to Europe and see things. Derek just got back. Typically, even though we think of John as being older within the scriptures, artists typically depict him as being much younger, beardless, with long hair. Sometimes when we look at depictions of the Apostle John today, he kind of looks like a girl. If you look at Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper, John, like, Jesus looks like he's sitting next to a woman. That's actually John. that was one of the key plot points of the Da Vinci Code, right? It was like, that's not John at all. That's Mary. Okay, so John is actually this one farthest to the right. I actually put these in order. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. So one of the things that happens with Luke is typically shown with like lots of papers because he's known as the historian, and he went, so he has like a couple of sheafs of papers sort of like falling out of his hand in there. The thing you should know about the Gospels is that they tell the story of Jesus' life from birth to death to resurrection to ascension. Right? If you need to know about any of those things, these are the four books you consult. They also confirm and fulfill the prophecies from the Old Testament that kind of told us about Jesus, that he was coming. Right? Did this one come out better? Looks like it came out better. So, there are several promises. We haven't talked about them explicitly, but they have been in the lesson books for those of you that are following along in the lesson books. But we're kind of looking at this for a different reason. How many of you think that like this looks like basic Bible doctrine? Reasonably basic. Okay, we do. How many of your friends that aren't here this morning would? How many of your friends that like have actually gone to churches, other churches for a long time that aren't churches of Christ, would look at this and be like, oh, that's pretty basic. Yeah, not really. Not really. How many scriptures are on there? How much time would you have to spend looking things up to interpret what this infograph is trying to tell us? Right? So, yeah, Genesis 3:15, Genesis 12:3, Deuteronomy 18:15, 2 Samuel 7:12-16, and then you have these correlating New Testament passages. So there's 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20. It's 20 passages, one page. You guys all think this is basic, right? Which is part of why I'm doing sort of a parallel study. Why do Church of Christ people think this is basic? A lot of people would not. Well, but I think it's not just, there's a reason why we particularly have focused on those things differently than other people who are Christians have done.
Within the church, most people who are in the church are used to the opportunity that they're given to find chapter verse for what they need to talk about. So, seeing something like that, you want to stay your faith. What you say is that when you go to the book, to the location where you see the pressure of what we know about the past.
And the point that I'm making is that most other churches wouldn't be asking for book, chapter, verse. Right? We have developed an expectation that everything we do should have book, chapters, and verses, and I'm going to tell you that expectation today came from a specific place. Right? And specific people. And it's been a tradition that's passed down. The epistles. Who are these guys? So just think, this is not basic Bible doctrine anymore. If you know all the writers of the epistles, and these are the ones that I haven't already shown you, so John's not on there a second time. Who are these guys? Which one's Paul? Okay, so in most European art, Paul is always seen carrying a sword around. Seems strange. Odd, right? Confusing. Why would he be carrying a sword around? Sorry? Because he's a Roman? Certainly not a Roman sword. What was Paul doing with the church before he got converted? Oh, running around killing people. Additionally, the second reason they always have the sword is, according to tradition, Paul was beheaded with a sword. So this is sort of like a remembrance of, you know, help people remember how this particular apostle died. So if the one with the sword is Paul, who's the one with the key? That would be Peter. Why a key? Okay, so Jesus at one point said, you know, I'll give you the keys to the kingdom. People have disagreed about what that meant, but the key tends to represent the apostle Peter. I can't tell you why Jude has a spear. I'm assuming it has something with the way he died. And that leaves James. So what do we find in the epistles? If we were to look there. Well, we are going to discover, first of all, that Jesus' teachings and significance are expanded on a lot in the epistles, right? So if, as we understand it, right, people were orally taught what had happened to Jesus and what his significance was, at some point, if you don't have a reference document in front of you, you may get hazy on those things, right? Or you may have some questions, and maybe the know-it-all at your church thinks he knows it all and comes up with a wildly different interpretation than what was initially taught. And that's why these letters are written. It's like, clear things up. Hey, no, you shouldn't be doing that. That's not what Jesus taught about. Here's what Jesus actually taught about. The other thing is that it gives significant testimony regarding the organization of Christians after the ascension of Christ, right? So since these are letters to churches, for the most part, which ones weren't to churches? Philemon and Jude. All right, so, but is there a point to explain exactly how churches get set up? Or what ought to be done there? So, they're clearing up a lot of teaching. There's evidence for how the first century church is set up in it, but are any of them a technical manual on what worship should be like when you get together or how we should organize this? But basically when people were screwing it up, right? Like, if someone's doing something wrong, now we've got an entry in the letter about how to do it right. How many accurate descriptions do you have of churches doing things right? Right? It's just like at school, the teacher always knows the names of the bad kids before they know the names of the good kids, right? You know, the good kids don't have very much documentation. Gus? Okay, so what's missing? You know, the Old Testament had a couple of books that prescribed every single thing that's supposed to be done, when it ought to be done, on what date, how frequently, the quality of the implements that are supposed to be there, right? How much is left to the imagination in the Old Testament? How much is left to the imagination in the New Testament? P- people have imagined an awful lot of ways to conduct worship in Christian churches. Now, if we look at the book, Basic Bible Doctrine, right? We have all the acts of worship, exactly how a church should be organized, exactly what should be happening in churches when it's assembled, right? And there's lots and lots of verses, right? So again, how many of y'all think of this as basic Bible doctrine? And yet, let's like take a step and say, first of all, very few of these things are explicitly stated, right? And there isn't a single book in the New Testament that's written with the purpose of giving us these specific understandings, right? I would argue that this is very advanced Bible doctrine. This is a century of painstaking research into the New Testament to find all of the pertinent examples, all of the veiled implications, all of the direct commands, and then correlate them onto two pages. Okay. If you were Barton W. Stone, did you have this sheet of paper? And Barton W. Stone would not have thought of this as particularly basic Bible doctrine. It would be basic in the sense that it came from the Bible only. But a lot of times when we say the word basic, what is it that we mean by basic? Oh, that's so basic. Simple, clear cut, clean.
But it's already been put together.
Yeah, yeah. Just plug and play. Like, you don't need a science degree to know this stuff. And yet, if we unpack this and see what's actually represented on this page is years of human effort and work to assemble everything that's relevant onto one page in a slick infograph, right? So I think part of this class, not only are we trying to understand ourselves and understand what we think of as basic, we're also trying to unpack this in a way that helps us understand what we frequently think of as the ununderstandable conduct of, you know, denominational Christians and Christians of other traditions. Okay? So I'm going to make the argument that even though this is fundamental, I would say that that's definitely an accurate term. This is fundamental teaching. To understand it as basic or simple is probably a misnomer. It's very basic to us, because you and I have been to 30 years of Bible classes in many cases, right, where this was drilled. I'm not going to ask for audience participation because I know that the visual quality here is poor, and we'll work on that. But if we just take a quick count of how many scriptures are here and how long it would take to study just this page that appears in Basic Bible Doctrine Volume 1. It's not even Volume 3, guys. You know, you haven't even gone through the first two. Like, this is basic. It's in the first volume. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, it's getting close to like 50 scriptures. You, who are familiar with Bible study, how long would it take y'all to look all those up? A while. And if you hadn't already read all those books and know what they were about, would reading that particular verse out of context necessarily be sufficient? So how basic does this seem? It's really, really not. I'd like to make the argument that a lot of you guys have like master's degrees in, you know, Bible. If you look at this and think, oh, that's pretty simple. Okay, fair enough. So why do we think of that really complicated page of basic Bible doctrine as being basic? Barton W. Stone, the Restoration Movement founder we talked about last week, didn't do a lot of that. He was solving particular problems as he encountered them. You know, like if he's reading the Bible and he sees, oh, that doesn't jive with what the Presbyterians think, maybe we shouldn't do that anymore. He's reacting sort of point by point by point. It's the Campbells. This is Thomas in the black and white photo, his son Alexander in the color portrait, that really study the Bible intensely to try and distill some overall truths about it that are going to create sort of like the canon of what the Restoration Movement carries forward as being, this is what first century Christianity looks like. Right? And it makes sense because Alexander Campbell is the president of a university, right? He's an academic. His father was university educated. I mean, Barton W. Stone was not. He was going to go to Hampton-Sydney College, but never did. He became a minister in the Presbyterian Church instead. These guys are university educated in Scotland, which has one of the best universities around at the time. And they're accustomed to doing deep research. And they've come to some conclusions about how the Bible ought to be interpreted. One of the things, and we were pointing out earlier, Nikki pointed out last week, that there are people before the Restoration Movement that said, maybe we ought to just study the Bible. And a lot of those people ended up dead, right? There are a couple of people that didn't end up dead. One of them was John Locke. Where do you guys know John Locke from? The American Revolution, okay. Thomas Jefferson plagiarized him in the Declaration of Independence. Like, the first several lines are like a quote from John Locke, right? So John Locke, important smarty pants in Britain. One of the things that he was concerned with is, how can we get Christians to stop murdering each other? Right? He was living in the decades after the 30 Years' War, which was a war that lasted for 30 years where Christians, where Catholics and Protestants tried to exterminate each other and frequently succeeded, you know, entire cities being burned alive and such. And he proposed that if we can all just agree on the essentials and then tolerate everyone else's opinions about things that aren't essential, that would be a way. Right? If we can distill down what are the basic points of Christianity that everyone has to believe, and then understand that everything else is like icing, gift wrapping, you know, flavor, that maybe that reprioritization would allow us to stop murdering each other on a grand scale. John Locke says that the essentials are things Jesus actually said, and everything else is kind of optional. Does anyone say that today?
We can say that, but we cannot.
Many do.
We have the red letter edition.
That is sort of the implication of the red letter edition, right? And there's several interested parties, particularly in the United States, that use the justification for their behavior that, well, Jesus never explicitly condemned that, right? A couple of his students did, but the man didn't, right? That's a really popular argument in the LGBT movement, and that's one of the arguments that led to the Episcopalian Church not only allowing women ministers, but also gay ministers. So this is still, like, a really popular idea. Obviously, like, we can resonate with this a little bit, but I think we would have a different take on it, right? We wouldn't say that the only essentials are things that Jesus actually said. The other influence for the Campbell movement was English Puritans. What did the Puritans want to do? they thought the Protestant movement, breaking off from the Catholic Church, was good, but it was only a good start. Right? Their intent was to purify the church. They wanted to break it down to a much more primitive condition. They wanted to make it like it was in the first century. Now, a lot of times they were doing this without the assistance of a Bible, right? And they were doing this without the benefits of a formal education. So, in a sense, the Campbell movement marries this high-level philosophical education that they had received at Edinburgh University with the intent of these English Puritans. And they start acting on that when they get to North America. Thomas Campbell in 1809, so he's overlapping with Barton Stone now, right? Barton Stone was doing stuff around this time. Forms the Christian Association of Washington in 1809. I read y'all's a part of what Barton W. Stone wrote in the last will and testament of the Springfield Presbytery. I'm not going to read this because Thomas Campbell writes a lot more than Barton W. Stone. He's a scholar, right? And he writes like it. But he establishes an association that Christians of any denomination could join to talk about and think about and figure out ways for Christians to act in unity together. What do we call that today? There is a word for that. We're not associated with it a lot of times. It's not one of our words, but you know, lots of other Christians know this word. Starts with an E. Not, I'm sorry? No, that's one of our words. Even. So this is like the start of the ecumenical movement, right? This is where, you know, you'll see like Catholic priests and Episcopalian priests and Baptist ministers all get together and they'll have dinners and they'll try and figure out like, okay, what do we think about this? What can we all agree on? Like, you know, we're seeing disturbing things happening in society. Can Christians of all stripes come together and like say, no, this is not cool, or promote acts of unity together? The ecumenical movement doesn't exist yet, so Thomas Campbell is kind of moving ahead of the social trends. And a big part of the declaration and address is Thomas Campbell saying, by the way, we're totally not a church. Okay? This is a free will association. It's basically like a club. You don't have to leave your church to be part of ours, our organization, our association, right? And he believed that unity could be achieved by distinguishing between things that were matters of faith and things that were matters of opinion. Okay, which he doesn't exactly quote Locke. He's a little more elegant than Jefferson in that regard. He doesn't say essentials and non-essentials. He says matters of faith and matters of opinion, right? Now, I'm going to spoil the ending for you. The people that joined the Christian Association of Washington ended up liking it so much that they made it a church. Thomas Campbell was really conflicted about this. He was like, but we told people that we're not a church. He said, but this is way more churchy than the churches that we all go to. Why don't we make it a church? And so there was a lot of controversy that went along with this. But I want to focus on this idea of dividing between faith and opinion by focusing on a few Restoration Movement slogans. Some of these may sound familiar to you. Where the scriptures speak, we speak. Where the scriptures are silent, we are silent. The Church of Jesus Christ on earth is essentially, intentionally, and constitutionally one. We are Christians only, but not the only Christians. In essentials, oh, you hear that John Locke coming up again. In essentials, unity. In opinions, liberty. In all things, love. No creed but Christ. No book but the Bible. no law but love, no name but the divine. All right? These are all slogans that kind of come out of this teaching of Thomas Campbell. That, have y'all ever heard these uttered? Most of these are familiar? All right. Okay, so we must have found people that are related to us. Yeah. It's funny how you can do that when you're studying genealogy. I remember one day my mom got a will sent from Virginia to our house because Dad found someone he thought might be, you know, related to us, and he wanted to look at the will and see if he could identify anyone. And the will started out in such a way that we were like, yep, no, definitely Perkins. The will started out, you know, being unsound in body, but being right and sharp, clear in mind, as usual. Right? This is very Perkins sentiment. We have a very high opinion of our mental faculties. So here's the class participation. We have 10 minutes. You've all heard these slogans, and you guys looked at those graphics and said, yeah, those were definitely basic Bible doctrine. And one of the basic principles is, you know, we need to know what the essentials are. So here's what I want to know is, what are the things that you think of as essential, and what are the things that you think of as optional or non-essential?
Are you talking about Christian assembly, or are you talking about our personal belief?
Is there a distinction?
No. One distinction is baptism.
Baptism. All right, baptism not to join an organization, baptism for remission of sins. Christ, not a man, deity, or not a man only, right? Just that we partake of the Lord's Supper, or is there a way? Do we partake of the Lord's Supper differently than other people?
Every first day. Jesus Christ, death, resurrection, and appearances.
That those things happened?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry?
Love and unity in the church.
Is supposed to characterize our behavior. That's right. So, what are the non-essentials? What are the things that you're willing to tolerate differences on? Order of worship, location. That's terrible. I heard someone go, ooh.
I didn't hear that.
Okay. Whether or not the church building is sacred.
And not in the middle.
church building sacred? Is this stuff you're not allowed to do here?
That is